From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the sixth day of March 2012, a Tuesday afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll hear a conversation I had yesterday, Monday, with Daryl Good, ag economist at the U of I, about the commodity markets, the WASDE numbers due out at the end of this week, and in particular the grain stocks and acreage figures, which are due at the end of the month. We talk for about 20 minutes, a really good conversation. Stay with us for that. And then as we close out the program, we'll take up not the weather forecast, but discuss the pork industry with Chris Hurt at Purdue. And it all happens right here on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world from the University of Illinois.
Support for stock and commodity reports on Illinois Public Media comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, now hosting risk management seminars. A complete list of seminars is at sfarmmarketing.com.
Well, first things first, no numbers from the CME Group or the Board of Trade this afternoon. Why? Because I'm not in studio today. I'm at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana for the all-day Agriculture Outlook meeting. In fact, if all things went well, we should be finished up and farmers should be in their trucks on the way home listening to this program. Thank you if you made it to the all-day Agriculture Outlook meeting. If not, please do visit our website over the next week or so. We'll be posting programming content from the All Day Ag Outlook at willag.org. It was a great program, I am positive, and you will want to come and see and even watch some of that programming. Now, one thing that did happen today that I want to make sure that you know about. Paul Cooley from ADM Investor Services has been volunteering with our radio station for about 27 years. Now, to the best of our knowledge, he spent at least 40,100 minutes on the air over that time. That's roughly a month, round the clock. So 30 days, round the clock, on the air since 1985. And not only that, he volunteered the time and he came up with many of the programs. That's right, Paul Cooley from ADM and the late Charles Lindy sat down along with the late Paul Bates and started hashing out some of the programming content that eventually became what you listen to on our radio stations today. Without Paul, these programs would not exist. And we thank him so very much for that gift of time and talent and treasure that he has made over the last nearly three decades. Paul, thank you for all that you've done for agriculture in our part of the world. And we wish you the best as you retire from Archer Daniels Midland.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 95 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Here's a quick look at the weather forecast for the Urbana-Champaign area. This evening should be partly cloudy, a low of 43. It'll be breezy with a south wind at 18 to 21, gusting all the way to 36. And then tomorrow, sky should be sunny with a high of 63 degrees, windy, a south wind at 20 to 23, gusting to 29 and 32, and maybe all the way up to 40. Wednesday night, showers and thunderstorms are likely. It'll be cloudy. A low of 47 degrees on Wednesday evening, breezy, with a southwest wind between 11 and 21, gusting to 29. Chance of precipitation Wednesday night, now set at 60%. Thursday showers likely, mainly before noon. It'll be cloudy with a high near 50. Thursday night cloudy and a low of 35. And Friday mostly sunny with a high near 48 degrees.
Support comes from Murray Wise Associates, a nationwide agricultural advisory firm and land auction company specializing in the acquisition, management, and disposition of farmland and agribusiness investments. Land, auctions, agribusiness. More information is at murraywiseassociates.com.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It's a Tuesday afternoon. Daryl Good, ag economist from the U of I, visited me in studio yesterday to take up the commodity markets and how he sees things evolving in the coming years. On Monday morning, Daryl, thanks for being here, by the way, you wrote an article about the stocks report, which is coming up at the end of the month. The next kind of important USDA report, WASDE, is coming out later this week. But the stocks report, the big one, along with the acreage numbers, and made some suggestions about that report being important and widely variable. Why don't you take me through those suggestions to begin with?
Well, the way we anticipate the March 1 stocks inventory on corn is pretty straightforward. You start with what we had on hand December 1 and then make some calculation of how much corn was consumed since December 1, and that will give you a forecast of March 1 stocks. So you kind of look at consumption in three categories, ethanol, exports, and feed use. And we have weekly numbers on exports and ethanol production, so we can make reasonable estimates of how much corn was consumed in those two categories for the quarter. And then other processing uses of corn are pretty consistent from year to year, so that number is not going to vary much. So about 450 million bushels of corn exported December through February, 1.3 billion probably processed into ethanol, another 320 million bushels for other seed, food, and industrial uses. And so that leaves the feed and residual calculation. And the thing that makes that difficult, of course, is that we've had some surprising stock numbers in the last 2 years and some very inconsistent patterns of feed and residual use quarter by quarter. So we kind of lost track of what's normal or how do we calculate expected feed use for the quarter. And so one way to start is to say, well, USDA for the year is projecting 4.6 billion bushels. Let's assume that's correct. And then let's look at a normal seasonal distribution of that 4.6 billion. And then typically you're pretty consistent first half of the year, second half of the year. And we already have an estimate for the first quarter. So if you say, typically, X percentage of feed use is in the first half of the year. We already know what first quarter was. We can make a guess of what second quarter was. The problem I alluded to is that the percentage consumed in the first half of the year has been very, very inconsistent the last 4 years. So we've kind of lost track of what is normal now. And if we revert back to that period prior to the most recent 4 years, you know, feed use was more consistent, averaging about 64% in the first half of the year. So you could use that as normal. That would get you a forecast of March 1 stocks, roughly 6.2 billion bushels. Say the last 4 years, we've used 70% of total in the first half of the year. If we were doing that, then you would be looking at a different stock number. I've got those reversed a little bit. Under a smaller use number, you'd be at 6.5. Under a 70% use first half, you'd be at a 6.2 billion bushel number if the 4.6 billion bushel projection is correct. So it's a tremendous number of moving parts there that give you a very wide range on potential for the March stocks report, as much as 300 million bushels perhaps. It could be justified depending on your assumptions here. So where that number actually comes in is going to be extremely important.
In the recent years, has that number been, it's been on the bigger side, the 70%, right?
In the recent years, it has been. But even then, not consistently, one of those 4 years, we were at 65% use in the first half. And in one of the 4 years, we were at 76% use in the first half. That was last year. So what is normal? We kind of lost our bearings here a little bit because of these surprising stock numbers that we've had since June of 2010.
So 300 million would do what to ending stocks for 11, 12?
Well, I mean, where that number comes in would change your expectation about the total for the year. I guess the point I'm making anywhere within that range could still mean that $4.6 billion for the year is right. It's just what is the seasonal distribution. But I'm guessing if we come in at the low end of that, $6.2 billion or smaller, then the market's going to be thinking a bigger feed use for the year and smaller year-ending stocks and vice versa. And the point being, we don't have much playroom here with the projection already at $800 million. $600 million is about as low as you can go at year-end. So anything that suggests that we're feeding much more than 4.6 makes things very, very tight. And then the point I made is something seems to be in the works here with the pattern of corn prices that we've seen here recently with the ongoing extremely strong basis on corn and now an inverted futures market where March is premium to both May and July futures, acting very much like a short crop, short supply market, seems to be saying something's going on here. Either farmers are just really reluctant to give it up, it's not there, or we're using more corn than people think we're using because that corn is just not flowing to market fast enough to meet needs and bases and the carry continues to try to encourage that to market.
I'm going to try to simplify some of the numbers, but I don't know whether I can do it correctly. So at 801 million bushels, current carryover, current projected carryover, if we have a 300 million bushel swing, are we talking, and you say 600 would be about as low as we can go, but if we, you're saying 300 million bushels on either side of 800, so we could be at we could be 500 million or we could be at 1.1?
No, I'm really saying a 300 million bushel swing on the March 1 inventories, and then the question is how would the market use that to change their expectations about year-ending stocks?
Right.
Because in my mind, whether we're at 6.2 or 6.5 on March 1 could still mean, as I said, that we've correctly projected
800. Right.
But the market may not see it that way when we get the numbers.
And because there's a difference in how fast if we're at 70% or 65%
right,
or whatever that case might be. And it's been very variable, and even by the time we got to June, too.
Right.
That number's really...
And so that's the point. We won't know until September how fast, what was the seasonal distribution. All we can do now is make a guess at that.
But the indication at this point is that we may be shorter of corn than we think, or farmers are stronger holders than we suspect they might be.
Yes. I mean, the basis and the lack of carry, the inversion in the futures market is just telling us that the market is continuing to have to entice more corn into the marketplace. And again, is that because those stocks are much tighter than we think, or farmers are just holding tighter, and or the market is using more corn in the feed sector than has been forecast? And so you have people on both sides of that debate, and some suggesting, we're going to find ourselves very short of corn this summer because consumption is continuing at a more rapid pace. So going to be interesting to see.
Can you? Yeah, it will be very. Could you divine anything from the animal units that they've been tracking?
All we know is that 4.6 billion bushel projected use in combination with the estimates on all the other feed categories, including our own estimate of how much distillers we will feed, gives you a very small disappearance total feed per animal unit. So there's a lot of things pointing to the possibility that the 4.6 billion bushel projection is really too small. But they're only indications at this point.
Now, turn your attention to the acreage figure. And we can talk about the March 30 report, but the one we've got in hand came from the Ag Forum a couple of weeks ago. That's 94 million acres of corn. They use an awfully big number in your mind, I think, for trend yield at 164 bushels to the acre.
Well, they do. The market seems to have come to a consensus real quick on the acreage, the 94 million that the USDA is using is pretty consistent with what other people have been talking about, you know, one side or the other of that. And so that may not be much of a surprise when we get that report. But the real question, as you indicate, is what kind of growing season and what kind of yield will we have? And more importantly, at this juncture, what is a realistic expectation, even about trend yield? USDA's 164 is well above any trend calculation that I can manufacture, and would be probably 5 bushels above what I use as a trend yield for 2012. And so 5 bushel on, you know, 85 to 90 million acres harvested, you're talking a huge difference in potential size of next year's crop.
Yeah, so instead of 14 billion bushels, we're...
Maybe 13.5 is even with 94 million planted, might be the right number.
And if we're at 13.5 and usage looks like 13.5, then we're back at... And then we're still at 800 million for carryout and by the time we get to the fall of 2013.
Right. And if for some reason you'd actually fall below trend, then you've got a problem again next year. So, I mean, we're all leaning towards more acres, higher yield than we had in 2011, a bigger crop, increasing stocks, a lower price. And that seems to be a reasonable expectation for next year. But the $64,000 question is what kind of summer will we have in 2012?
That's a big question, and one we won't know the answer to for a long time yet.
No, it'll be obviously unfold in pieces. I mean, we'll see how fast we plant the crop and what kind of condition the crop goes into the ground. And people will generally think the earlier the planted, the more rapid we plant, the higher the yield potential. And I think that's generally true, everything else equal. The earlier you get it in the ground, the better your chances are. But at the end of the day, it's really July weather that's going to determine corn yield.
Does your thought process on this crop under a normal growing year, which would put us at a 13.5 million bushel corn crop on 94 million acres, make a difference in the way a producer might consider marketing the crop and what they should do with their crop insurance decisions?
You know, I'm a real proponent of the crop revenue insurance, particularly this year, where we can do a trend-adjusted APH yield, where RMA has come out with a really low volatility factor for 2012, and we're seeing some increased subsidies. Crop insurance, you can get really reasonable coverage at very low cost this year. So to me, in most cases, you know, the crop insurance is kind of a done deal. People will do that. And then the question is, how do you market your new crop around that insurance price of $5.68 Dease corn? Again, I've always been a proponent of, if prices below or equal that early in the season, it takes kind of the pressure off from being real aggressive. It's only as prices move above that and well above that we need to be more aggressive marketers. And as always, I think spreading out sales and doing things in relatively small increments is a way to really manage the unknown of what's coming this growing season. I get a little nervous when folks make sales in really big chunks, given the environment we're in right now.
Can you define well above 568? Is that 40 cents above it? Yeah, 30 cents? What's well above?
Yeah, clearly, $6 corn is... more attractive than 568, but it's all in degrees, and the more you get above it, the more aggressive you are, I think, is the way to think about it.
Right, so scale in, and you scale in starting someplace that you feel comfortable that's well above the marketplace.
Yeah, and I suspect a lot of people have already started marketing new crop, although reports we get from the country suggest that new crop cash sales have not been nearly as aggressive as a year ago when people... we're pretty aggressive and perhaps are a little more reluctant this year because last year's forward bids turned out to be relatively low.
Finally, acreage battle, corn and soybeans. We talk about this year in and year out. Seems like this year we didn't think we were going to have to talk about it, but it kind of looks like there might be a bit of a battle at this point. Tell me where those acres normally might be. Are they sometimes in Illinois? Are they on the fringe areas? And which way would you lean at this point?
Well, we're expecting the increase in planted acres this year over 2011 primarily to come from fewer prevented planted acres than we had last year. FSA reported over 9.5 million acres intended for planting but didn't get planted last year. A big chunk of that was wheat in the southern plains, but we also had corn in the eastern corn belt and some soybeans that didn't get planted. But most of the unplanted would be in the plains states. So that'll give us room for more wheat and more feed grains, I think, in those areas. Some talk about reduced cotton acres that might free up acreage for both corn and soybeans in the southeast. We had a few acres come out of the CRP. Again, those tend to not be in the heart of the Corn Belt. But total acreage, we should have a lot more planted acres of crops than we had in 2011. And then the calculation that most people are doing for the Midwest, saying, okay, let's look at the budgets, corn on corn versus soybeans on corn acres, and which pencils out to be more profitable. And, you know, using average costs here in central to northern Illinois and today's new crop bids, it still shows a pretty good advantage to corn over corn, unless there's a pretty good yield penalty for doing that. Even building in a slight yield penalty, still showing, you know, $70 an acre more favorable to corn. So I think that's a reason that, obviously, that the market expects more corn acres, that the price, even though soybeans have gone up a lot in the past 5 weeks, corn is still pretty competitive.
I have a bit of an odd question for the end. There are places on the planet, even in the United States, where basis is always over the futures price. Generally, that doesn't happen in the Midwest. It's been that way for a very long time, months now, this season. Is there any reason when the United States is the largest or has been the largest exporter of corn on the market and the largest, certainly, producer of corn in the world, to think that the Midwest primary growing regions would have bases over the futures markets in the future permanently or in some permanent state?
You know, I think that would be hard to justify at this juncture. We always think within the U.S. that prices, cash prices, are over the futures in deficit areas like the Southeast feed industry or the Gulf export markets, and they always think about cash prices being under futures in surplus production areas where corn has to move out of the area. And I think the best guess moving forward is we'll return to that kind of price relationship, that a positive basis here in the heart of the Corn Belt, I don't think, is the norm moving forward.
Darryl, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Todd.
Darryl Good, ag economist from the University of Illinois, joining us here on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. We'll say goodbye to some of our radio stations for now. For the rest of you, stay with us. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. We'll take up the pork industry with Purdue ag economist Chris Hurt. I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
It's National Chocolate Cheesecake Day. The first mention of cheesecake in history was during the ancient Olympic Games. Cato the Elder, who was born in 234 BC, wrote of cheesecake preparation in his farming manual, De Agricultura. It's the oldest surviving work of Latin prose, which looked at up-to-date agricultural practices. American-style cheesecakes relying on cream cheese was invented in 1872. This new high-fat cheese was developed for the Empire Cheese Company and later became known as Philadelphia brand cream cheese, which is now widely used in the creation of cheesecakes. It's also National Frozen Food Day. It was Clarence Birdseye who invented and commercialized a method for quick freezing food products. In 1923, Birdseye used a $7 electric fan, buckets of brine, and cakes of ice for packing fresh food into waxed cardboard boxes and flash freezing them under high pressure. In 1930, retail frozen foods went on sale for the first time in Springfield, Massachusetts. Various fruits, vegetables, meat, and fish were offered for sale. On this day in agricultural history in 1899, aspirin was patented by Felix Hoffmann of the German company Bayer. Aspirin was first sold as a powder. The first tablets were produced in 1915. And in 1912 on this date, Nabisco debuted the Oreo cookie. Originally, the Oreo was mound-shaped and came in two flavors, lemon meringue or cream. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a Tuesday afternoon. Well, 5 years ago, people in the United States, on average, ate about 5 more pounds of pork in a year than they did last year. Purdue Ag economist Chris Hurt thinks that's about to change, and that pork will soon be on the increase in U.S. diets. It's a little strange, but the numbers say that even while consumers in the United States were consuming less pork over the last 5 years, pork producers in the U.S. were ramping up. It's part of that push towards exports the Obama administration has been touting as a way out of the economic slump. That also has a lot to do with the increasing taste for red meat in nations like China, says Purdue Extension Ag economist Chris Hurt.
There's a saying, China is going to eat your lunch. And that statement does have some limited truth. China was the 6th largest buyer of pork from the U.S. back in 2006, and that represented about 5% of U.S. pork exports. But now they've moved up to the 3rd largest buyer, at least last year in 2011, representing not 5%, but 15% of U.S. exports.
China's recent history, says Purdue's Chris Hurt, has exhibited an inconsistent pattern of buying pork in the world market. As recently as 2004 to 2006, China was a net exporter of pork, selling more to the world than they purchased from the rest of the world. Since 2007, however, they have been a net importer, but an inconsistent one.
That inconsistency arises from them buying large amounts when they need pork, like back in 2008, due to internal pork diseases and, of course, the Olympics were in Beijing.
And the Chinese were big importers again in 2011 when pork price inflation was high and they needed to quickly increase internal supplies. That is to say that in-country supply wasn't enough to meet demand, so China bought U.S. pork. However, thanks Chris Hurt, the future direction of pork exports to China remains unclear.
Within China, the preference clearly has been to raise their own pork and only buy from the world market when their internal production is short. They certainly are rapidly increasing their production, so I think the race is on to see if they are able to increase their domestic production as quickly as their internal demand is rising.
What does it mean to the U.S. marketplace? Well, first, Japan is the number one importer of U.S. pork. It consistently buys about 30-35% of total production in this nation. Mexico is second. Last year, 20% of the U.S. pig crop went south of the border. These markets all are expected to stay strong in the future. It does not mean, however, less pork for U.S. consumers. On the contrary, Chris Hurt thinks pork consumption is poised to go higher in the good old U.S. of A.
That pork expansion will be brought on by strong profitability, which began back in the spring of 2011, and hopefully by moderating feed prices. Now, a third supporting force will be the very low levels of beef that's going to be available for the next several years and into 2015.
Naturally, there is a caveat. It's the price of feed, corn, and soybean products. It's still dependent on a return to normal yields in the United States for the 2012 crops. For that reason, Chris Hurt says the pork industry should view 2012 as a transition year to those more moderate feed prices. That still depends on rebuilding corn and soybean inventories with more normal yields. Hey, thanks so much for being with us on this Tuesday afternoon. Be sure to visit our website. The address is WILLAG.org. There we'll be sure to post parts of our all-day agricultural outlook that took place at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. I'm Todd Gleason.